This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I mean, the ideal is that I, as an old man, I'm sitting on a park bench feeding ducks in my later years, when a woman literally in a lab coat walks past and goes, oh my God, I'm a scientist because I read your books when I was a kid. This obviously is a ridiculous leap of, why am I feeding ducks? Why is this woman still wearing her lab coat while walking through the park? Like, whatever. There's so many things wrong with this fantasy. But the general gist is, hopefully, you sow a seed.
You're listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.
Hello and welcome to the Science Focus podcast. I'm Alexander McNamara, online editor at BBC Focus magazine. Comedian and TV presenter Dara O'Brien became hooked on maths after studying black holes and the shape of space as a teenager. He went to university to pursue maths and mathematical physics, before veering way off course into comedy and science communication, hosting shows like Mock the Week and Stargazing Live. He's drawn on skills from all of those areas to create his second science book for kids, called Secret Science: The Amazing World Beyond Your Eyes. In it, he details the tiny and invisible things that are very, very important to everyday life. We talked to Dara about the joys and challenges of communicating science to kids, and what to do if you find science boring. He shares his favourite nerdy science joke with us, as well as why he's fascinated by the sleeping habits of giraffes, and the details of the disappearance of the Brontosaurus. Here's BBC Focus editorial assistant Helen Glennie, talking to Dara O'Brien.
You studied maths and physics at university?
Maths and mathematical physics in UCD in Dublin. Like it's a specific, it was a specific kind of sort of fast track for those who just want, who really wanted to get down to the mathematical stuff without any of the kind of dusty practical kind of soldering yourself to the table kind of thing. So it narrowed really, really quickly into doing just very, very mathematical content immediately. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you remember as a child how you first got into science? How you decided?
I remember the point where I knew it was very, at that point when you were about 14, when you really registered. I don't remember specifically being into it before that any more than just that usual curiosity we all have, hopefully. But I remember, and I've had conversations with this with various scientists I know and science writers I know, that there's a point about 14 where it sort of grabs you. Mm-hmm. In a big way. So for me, it was like a teacher who went off-piste in in science lectures and started, because there was a point where it was before we had to get to any syllabus for exams, so we kind of kept it very open and very kind of this amazing thing or that amazing thing, and he was doing Shape of the Universe and black holes and all that kind of stuff, like whatever, and I got very, and that grabbed me, mm-hmm. I remember, in a huge way. So the and also then reading In Search of Schrodinger's Cat by John Gribben, and various other popular science books around the time. So it was about 14.
And did you ever, after doing those studies, did you ever consider entering academia?
No, it wasn't really the... I toyed with the notion, I think I had myself down for a couple of different master's programmes then, but then ran a newspaper instead in the college, mm-hmm. And then put it down for a different master's programme, then for journalism, and then ended up getting loads of work, so I didn't even do that. So I have kind of an ongoing respect for those who went ahead and did the kind of more less thankless than comedy is, because we get thanked every 30 seconds if we're doing it right. So those have actually done the more difficult thing that requires actually years of work and then producing something to without getting 1,000 people in the room cheering, applauding you. I admire that. Yeah, I think it's a character flaw of mine that drove me to showbiz rather than to doing that. Like that. So no, but I never seriously, it was never seriously an option, because I just got drawn away into other things.
So you've ended up with these parallel careers as a science communicator and as a comedian.
Yeah.
And how did that come about?
Well, there's kind of a way it works. If you get any kind of note in television, they will sit you down and go, what other things do you like? Because it's useful to sort of cross-pollinate the schedules to have somebody go, well, actually, I'm also really into this. And so they know they can take an audience from one place and they'll bring it across to another. It was specifically there. So we're having conversations about doing something like that. But then somebody came with the idea for Stargazing Live, and they felt, particularly because Brian had just started doing stuff, that it'd be useful for Brian to have a broadcasting co-host. So someone who's there, whose job it is to be keeping an eye on the time and mm-hmm. let's move this along. And all, so Brian can get passionate and get lost in the subject, but somebody be there to go, well, that's great, Brian, but we're going to have to move along. So I was asked if I wanted to do that, like whatever. Now, it helps the fact that I know a bit about this, and so wasn't being unfazed by the conversations and stuff like that, and I was able to pitch in, not obviously at the level Brian does, but still able to pitch in mm-hmm. with things, and then and know when to go, Alison, can we just explain that a little bit better? Mm-hmm. But a lot of the job is being the responsible one when Brian's getting passionate and about something, to go, yeah, that's all very well, but there's an airplane hovering above Scandinavia wanting to give us live footage or something, so we're going to have to cut this off and go. I have a routine in the show, actually, a current show, about how there are people who genuinely think that when I interrupt Brian, because I have to go, Brian, I'm going to stop you there, that they think I do it because I'm jealous. They genuinely think that when I host Stargazing with Brian, that I sit there angrily thinking, have a look at the amount of attention he's getting. And coincidentally, around about the 4-minute mark, I go, I can't take this anymore. I have to stop him and move the entire show somewhere else.
Yeah,
just
out
of envy. Yeah, just because of me. When in fact, it's somebody shouting in my ear going, 10 seconds to Scandinavian footage or whatever, and I have to do that. But we both find that very funny. Yeah. It's been such a common thing. It's a common Twitter thing of going, oh, stop interrupting Brian. I'm not interrupting Brian. I'm hosting a show that Brian is on, and the show, and like, because also people probably don't realize Stargazing in particular is a tremendously coordinated show. The live 1 hour is like, you got this, then this, then this, then this, then this, and there's 4 different locations, and there's the camera crews here, and then Liz is off somewhere on the other side of the planet, and Tim Peake is arriving at the space station or whatever. So it's an incredibly produced show,
mm-hmm.
More so than I think we make it look, which is great. Mm-hmm. But it should flow really, really quick. The best produced shows, they flow really quickly. But but this one is boom, 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 and somebody has to be the one doing the thankless task. Yeah. So that's me doing that. And we used to have a show which called Back to Earth, which is the half hour after it, which we never had time. The first one was really rehearsed, and the second show was completely unrehearsed, mm-hmm. and that was honestly the most fun I've ever had in my professional life, because it was a completely unrehearsed that I basically controlled the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then we had complete scope to let the conversation flow. Well, meanwhile, there's a producer going, could we get that in? Could we get that in? And seeing the moment pass, whereas I'm just ignoring them and going, no, this show is just for talking now. So they needed basically someone with both the interest in the thing and, but also years mm-hmm. of live television to help anchor it. Mm-hmm. I'm the first to say that my job in all these things is to, when I'm doing the broadcasting, is to the person standing next to the expert. Uh-huh. And I get the information out of the expert. I'm not the one to... So actually doing a kid's book is sort of the perfect level in terms of, I love explaining it. I love bringing the passion across for these things. But I'm unlikely to... I honestly wouldn't deign to write the book that explains this to adults, because there are tons of great science writers out there who are also scientists as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that they'll do far better, and they'll bring far more to it. Whereas I can go, that's very interesting the way you've explained it, but I think I can explain it a bit better. Mm-hmm. And I can make it funny, and I can make them more appealing to a young audience. So that's a kind of a different skill set. You do still occasionally people going, oh yeah, did Brian help you to explain to you? And you're going, no, it's okay. Brian got this out of books, you know. I got also out of books. The stuff is in books. Brian didn't invent this stuff. The scientists also, we all came through school, and scientists had to be taught the same stuff as well. I just stopped attending these lectures after a while. But you know, all the information is out there. And that's possibly in itself a quietly thing. All this information is out there. It's not the preserve of any one group of people, mm-hmm. either whether it be astronomers or biologists or whatever, or scientists on the telly. It's no one's preserve. That information is all free to go. We're just repackaging it in an exciting way to draw you in again. Mm-hmm. But none of this is a secret.
Science, I think, especially among kids and teenagers who are learning at school, sometimes has this bad reputation of being boring or nerdy and all that. Do you feel like you kind of need to be a bit defensive of that? Is that part of, the science comedy thing is probably a really good way of...
It can be very, very good. I mean, there's a number of things there. Firstly, there are parts of science that are boring. And there's lots of points that involve classification, and they involve learning how to do things and learning methods. And the part of the education of it is teaching people things that they don't know why they're doing them, and they won't really realise until years and years later. So yeah, of course that's boring. Like whatever. Same as spelling. Learning spelling is boring. Same as learning tables is boring. Bits of science, they're just going to be. Unfortunately, doing laps is boring. Playing the football match is fun. You know, there's lots of parts mm-hmm. of life, unfortunately, that are boring. I'm no better than anyone else was in terms of doing the practice. But unfortunately, that's just sadly a part of life. We do a specific thing within this book, where in the first chapter we say, because this book, the first book I wrote was space, mm-hmm. and that's very straightforward. But in this book, we have a... it's about the invisible things of everyday life, and that's hormones and electrons and bacteria and forces, and so we're covering loads of different stuff, like whatever. And we have a thing in the first chapter where I say, listen, some of this you'll like less than others. Some of this just won't interest you, because that's the way it works. Like, I mean, I like, you know, my, for me personally, I don't know what I'm going to say is I love the physics-y bits, and the biologists have always kind of left me cold. It's not my thing. Mm-hmm. The flip side of which is, my wife is a doctor. I told her, it's a book about space. And she's going, space. whatever. Some people like some things, don't like other things. So we have a thing in the book which basically we say, skip it. If you don't like the bit, there's another bit just coming along which will be more your thing, and so go with that. And then at the end I go, right, so what bits do you skip? Because if you like these bits, then you could become a neuroscientist. If you like these bits, you might be into engineering. If you like these bits, you might be a botanist or a biologist or a doctor. If you like these bits, you could be a physicist. I mean, and they're all different questions, and they all want to find out things, and they all have things they don't know. And so we kind of make it a thing in that, totally accept that some of this can be a bit boring. And that's fine, then grand. Life's too short. Go find the thing you love, because you'll all end up specialising at some stage. So you might as well, when you're doing this, find the ones you love and then go find out more about that. Mm-hmm. So there is a thing. I mean, the flip side of which is I don't accept the term nerd as being an insult. I've forgotten when that was last an insult, mm-hmm. because it's been co-opted so much anyway by frankly people who don't deserve it, saying I like bands, so I'm a nerd, or I like Infinity Wars, so therefore I'm a nerd. No, what, the largest grossing movie of the year? Oh, you liked Star Wars? Oh, how unique. I did 4 years of maths in university. I am a nerd, right? You aren't a nerd because you liked Luke Skywalker. that doesn't qualify you as a nerd. So I find that term is a badge of honour more than anything else.
You mentioned this is your second science book for children. What motivated you to start writing for children? Was it that specific set of skills that you felt like you had?
There is a touch of it. Like the one thing that I know I can bring to this is like an enthusiasm and a passion, and these things excite me. And I thought this would be an interesting market in which to do that, and a group of people to say that to, because they are naturally scientists anyway. Kids ask questions. Kids are curious. Mm-hmm. This is an age at which is because it's we're not. About the process yet, they're about just the results and the funny things and the facts and stuff like that. So I mean, they'll get into it when you get a bit older, teenage years, then you have to start learning that, you know, this is how an experiment is and this is how you do this and this is an equation and all that. But right now it's all, you know, giraffe sleep for 5 minutes, wow, and that kind of stuff. So it's a nice age in which to it's an easier age to write for in some ways, because it is just look at this fun thing. And that's easier with space and stuff like that. And then hopefully within that context, you can slide in interesting concepts that will stick with them, hopefully. But I mean, the total ideal is that I, as an old man, I'm sitting on a park bench feeding ducks in my later years, when a woman in a white coat, literally in a lab coat, walks past and goes, "Oh my God, I'm a scientist because I read your books when I was a kid." This obviously is a ridiculous leap of why am I feeding ducks? Why is this woman still wearing her lab coat while walking through the park? Like, whatever. There's so many things wrong with this fantasy. But the general gist is hopefully you sow a seed. And that people go, "Oh yeah, that is quite fun. That is amazing that happens," like whatever. And then it sits with them. And so fingers crossed. First one, we did really well, got nominated for an award, Book Trust Award, and it was great, and we were really enthusiastic about it. This one is an interesting one because it's not about one thing. So this one will be, mm-hmm. intrigued how this one goes.
Nice. And you're a father yourself.
Yeah.
Are your kids interested in science?
Yeah, but in that kind of general way. I don't think any of them, as far as I know, well, one of them, it depends. Some of them, they're quite young. So difficult to tell, but I think one's more into, the eldest is probably more into the arts than into the sciences, and constantly apologises to me for that. As yet, we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
Too young.
Yeah, okay. And how important do you think it is for kids to grow up learning about science? Is that something that you're going to try and keep in your kids' lives as much as possible?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's important for anyone. I don't think it's one of our great achievements is discovering how the universe works, like whatever. We've two great towers, the arts and the sciences, the stuff we've created and the stuff we've discovered, and I think it's this fundamental part, and I think we've a tendency to box them off a bit and go, "Well, this is one thing and you're either into this or you're into the other," like the mm-hmm. I think that's a very weird state of affairs where people can't be curious about both. So we do as many visits to the V&A as we do to the Science Museum, and we're lucky to have them all kind of not far away from us. I think there is a world of exciting stuff there, I'm not intending to shut off any doors yet.
Mm-hmm. And what challenges have you found when you've been writing these books in terms of writing science stuff for kids?
The most fundamental challenge is you got to get stuff right, and that's a thing you don't really worry about too much when you've got when you're writing comedy shows. Also, because the second book in particular has touched on things that aren't my degree, aren't my specialization in any way, so getting that stuff checked and not then doing the QI thing of repeating old canards, and so that often happens, that stuff pops up that you're explaining how wings work and you have to kind of go, "Wait, no, it's actually not what we've been told for years about the shape of wings." At one stage we were talking about there's a hormone that the stomach releases called ghrelin, which is the one that basically tells the brain that we don't need any more food. And I was saying this to, again, to my wife, who's a doctor, and she said, what? I've never heard of that, like, whatever. And that is only recently been discovered. Ghrelin is, like, 10 years old as a thing, like, whatever. So there's a, it's a bit, it, you what you don't want to do is, you don't want to reinvent the brontosaurus. That's what you don't want to do. Because I remember the bit where I came back, where I loved the brontosaurus when I was a kid. Didn't think about the brontosaurus again for 15 years. Became a kids' TV presenter, and we were doing some item about something, about dinosaurs. And I said, oh, yeah, and the brontosaurus. And the guy went, there's no brontosaurus. The brontosaurus is
what?
Gone. The brontosaurus is gone.
What do you mean, gone?
There's no brontosaurus.
Did it never exist?
It never existed. Brontosaurus wow. was an incorrect thing. So the brontosaurus, as far as I know, anyway, somebody Google this, right?
They we'll check there before
yeah,
we
yeah, they've got the right one, but it was definitely, I think the brontosaurus was the one that, if you see current lists, like, our kids will never learn about the brontosaurus. Because it was, we put the wrong bone with the wrong hip bone or whatever, and we imagine a dinosaur that isn't there. So now some bit of it's an apatosaurus. I don't know what the exact thing, but the brontosaurus went in the, mm-hmm. by the mid 90s. By the 70s there was a brontosaurus. By the mid 90s there was no brontosaurus. Mm-hmm. I'm now going to look that up so I've got that definitely right. Are you googling brontosaurus? Yeah, because I've got to make sure I've definitely got it right. These brontosaurus. Yeah, because Diplodocus is still around. Uh-huh. Tyrannosaurus is still around. Like whatever. Stegosaurus. All those. Oh, they still exist. But the brontosaurus was just a thing that we thought was a thing, and by the time I came out, gone. It's like people, people who don't know what quarks are, you know. They're just, it moves on, and mm-hmm. you don't want to be doing your half-remembered stuff from mm-hmm. 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So did you end up coming up with a favourite fact from the book or a favourite part for you to write?
When I run through the book, because I can't, there's 300 pages of it, doesn't all pop in the head. But I'm very fond of the giraffe, just the comparison of the giraffe sleeps for 5 minutes, whereas the lion sleeps for 18 hours. And that is, if ever there's a dividend for being the lion, it's the fact you can sleep for 18 hours, whereas the giraffe grabs sleep for 5 minutes at a time.
Well, and then how long does it stay awake for? Is this five minutes quite often?
I'm not sure how. They used to think it didn't sleep at all.
Ah.
Because they never saw it sleep. But I think it manages to function like that. Yeah. But it's an awful life because you might get eaten by a lion. So it's constantly just keep being aware. Mm. Like, and there are different forms of sleep, obviously, whatever. There's loads of ones. This one that people, the air doesn't circulate in a plane. It's not the same air when you fly. Mm-hmm. The air, planes take in air through the engine and then they sweep the air through and out again. So there's a hole at the back of the plane where the air leaks out.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are in the presumption that you basically, you fart and the fart stays in the plane
for 18 hours.
No, it all gets swept out. Air comes into the engine and sweeps out and goes out again.
Oh, okay.
But the plane is pressurised. It isn't pressurised to ground pressure. Because that would be we fly high, and so you fly, let's say, I think it's 35,000 feet. The pressure in the plane is 6,000 feet because it's midway between the two. And so when your ears pop into it, they're not popping, you're not even at the pressure, that the air pressure that is outside. It just kind of, it picks a medium point,
mm-hmm.
so it's not like an enormous amount of pressure on the plane, like whatever. Mm-hmm. So it just eases the pressure a bit. So even though you're flying at 35,000 feet, your ears think you're at 10,000 feet, and then there's the ground. So it's a partial pressurization, which is quite things. I presumed it kept ground pressure the whole way through. It doesn't. It lifted a little bit. So you're less pressure, you're like about a half an atmosphere of pressure mm-hmm. in the plane, mm-hmm. but significantly less outside the plane.
Yeah, okay. So but not enough for it to be noticeable.
Yeah, exactly. I mean no, it's noticeable in the sense of your ears pop.
But
the ears pop no more than you would by diving 10 meters.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah. So the weight of the air in your head, of all the air in the head, is the same weight as 10 meters of water.
Ah, right.
Yeah. So it's one atmosphere. If you go down 10 metres,
uh-huh.
that's one ATM, one atmosphere
mm-hmm.
of pressure. So you've gone in the 10 metres of water pushing down on you is the same as all of the air pushing mm-hmm. down on you. Because the air is bouncing around all mm-hmm. the place. It's not the tonnage of the actual molecule, it's because it's all pushing off different directions. But, so in other words, do you dive?
I've done it a few times.
Yeah, exactly. You know the way you have to... Yeah. Pop your head, yeah. Mm-hmm. Same, because you're good on 10 meters,
uh-huh.
it's the same change of pressure as flying a plane.
Ah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Nice. Now, I definitely can't get away with coming here and interviewing you and not asking you whether you have a favourite science joke.
Oh, God, they're all terrible, though. I do,
terrible
but
ones
I mean,
are good sometimes.
But the My favorite is the mathematical, the most nerdy one, the purpose of a great science degree. What did you do? What's your background?
Neuroscience.
Neuroscience. Okay, yeah. Great. Okay, that wonderful science on neuroscience, mm-hmm. but of no use. You will not get this.
Yeah, okay. Takes the pressure off.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, genuinely the greatest science degree is, what does the B in Benoit B. Mandelbrot stand for?
What does it stand for?
It stands for Benoit B. Mandelbrot. And if you're a mathematician, that is a hilarious joke. Genuinely a brilliant joke. Do you remember seeing chaos theories, those fractals? The only things you zoom in on, and every time you zoom in, the same pattern appears, the same pattern appears. They're called Mandelbrot sets.
Oh, okay.
And his name was Benoit B. Mandelbrot. And if the B stands for Benoit B. Mandelbrot, that means every time you zoom in, it's Benoit B. Mandelbrot.
Gotcha.
Benoit B.
Mandelbrot, Benoit B. Mandelbrot.
If you're a mathematician, that's a cracker joke. That's an amazingly funny joke.
Nice.
But all these stupid ones about, like, an electron walks into a bar. No, screw that. You want a proper hardcore science joke, is that.
That was comedian Dara O'Brien, whose new book, Secret Science, The Amazing World Beyond Your Eyes, is out now. Thanks for listening to the Science Focus podcast. The October issue of BBC Focus magazine is out now. And in it, we discover how we could leave Earth for good and build a new civilization in space. We also speak to a panel of leading female scientists about why there are so few women in science, discover why curry is so good for you, and explore whether machine learning could help shed new light on the problem of male suicide. Find out more at sciencefocus.com.
Thank you for listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.